Good morning. As you may recall, our friend the Reverend Mr. Sandlin has in recent weeks been talking about the many ways in which we're interconnected. So in his absence, and we certainly hope he's enjoying his time at the beach, I'm going to contribute my few thoughts on the subject. And you may have deduced that from the title, A New Fuse. Maybe not. I will try to explain. As some of you know, I've spent most of my professional life in design and technical production work for the stage, lighting and scenery for dance and theater. Over the years, I developed a peculiar fondness for a decidedly mediocre play called Light Up the Sky. The play is itself about the production of a new play, one which its backers proclaim will stick a Roman candle in the tired face of show business. Things are not going well, and disaster is widely predicted. An outsider becomes acquainted with some members of the production team and inquires of one of them, "Are you connected with show business too?" And the response is, "Yeah, I'm connected, but I need a new fuse." Most of us are of an age when we remember fuses. This was written over 60 years ago, so fuses rather than circuit breakers were the norm. So if there was an electrical overload, the fuse would blow rather than damage equipment or set things on fire. But doesn't that image encapsulate how we feel sometimes? Aren't there moments in our lives when we confront information overload, or perhaps more accurately, misinformation overload, and our fuse gets blown? At least mine does. It's a matter of self-protection. So let me be a contrarian for a moment and suggest that in some ways we may be too interconnected. So maybe we need a new fuse. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should acknowledge that my authority to talk about this stuff is suspect at best. I don't do Facebook. I don't tweet. I don't do LinkedIn or any of the other social media. And this is my phone. Okay, so you are perfectly free to disregard everything I have to say, but I have to also say that most of the time I'm content, and in fact I sometimes even revel in my degree of disconnectedness. I don't think I need to remind you that there's just more everything, more stuff vying for our attention these days than at any time in our history. And I absolutely understand the frustration which causes some citizens to just throw up their hands or cover their ears and eyes at their inability to absorb or distill it all. Those reactions can't possibly be healthy for a society. It seems to me that our biggest threat isn't the omnipresent government surveillance and public manipulation that George Orwell talks about in his novel 1984, where this dystopian culture, if you read it, we are told that war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. Orwell was wrong. You don't need repression. You only need the sensory overload of an age of numbingly ephemeral social media. Those are lines from a recent essay by political pundit Charles Krauthammer. I don't often agree with Mr. Krauthammer, but as far as I'm concerned, in this instance, he got it exactly right. We can be beaten into submission by this onslaught of talking heads, Instagrams and tweets, to the point where we're becoming what Leonard Pitts describes as a post-factual America. He laments the America of the last 20 years, where untruth is gospel, reality is multiple choice, and facts are whatever you have testicles enough to say, and somebody's dumb enough to believe. And I would add that it helps if you say whatever you're saying often enough and at the top of your lungs, and personally attack anyone who challenges those assertions you're using as your facts. So I can understand an inclination to retreat into our gated communities, whether they're literal or figurative. But that's a tendency that can only foster mistrust and suspicion. Just last Sunday, there was a piece in the newspaper by a resident of Eden named David Camp, who has founded an organization called the DWC Group, DWC standing for Dialogue, Wisdom, and Collaboration. Here are a couple of things that he points out. The recent Huffington Post YouGov poll found that 70% of Democrats can't understand why anyone would vote for Donald Trump. And 77% of Republicans don't get why anyone would support Hillary Clinton. And not only are we not curious about the other side, our social groups don't give us much chance for contact. A recent Pew Research study found nearly two-thirds of consistent conservatives and about half of consistent liberals say most of their close friends share their political views. So how can such dynamics not be toxic to our society? And more important, what can we do about them? Well, I've recently come across some thoughts from a Unitarian theologian and author named Forrester Church that have helped me sort of reframe some of my angst. He describes all of creation as what he terms the cathedral of the world, and he describes it as a vast room with innumerable windows through which the room is bathed in light. So here's how he continues the description. Above all else, contemplate the windows. In the cathedral of the world, there are windows beyond number. Some long forgotten, covered with many patinas of grime. Others revered by millions, the most sacred of shrines. Each, in its own way, is beautiful. Some are abstract, others representational. Some dark and meditative, others bright and dazzling. Each window tells a story about the creation of the world, the meaning of history, the purpose of life, the nature of humankind, the mystery of death. The windows of the cathedral are where the light shines through. Because the cathedral is so vast, our life so short, and our vision so dim, we're able to contemplate only a bit of the cathedral, explore a few spaces, reflect on the play of light and darkness through a few of its myriad windows. A 21st century theology, based on the concept of one light and many windows, offers to its adherents both breadth and focus. Honoring multiple religious approaches, it only excludes the truth claims of the absolutists. That's because fundamentalists claim that the light shines through their window only. Some, as we know from painful recent experience, go so far as to beseech their followers to throw stones through other people's windows. Now, skeptics draw the opposite conclusion. They see the bewildering variety of windows and observe the folly of the worshipers and conclude that there is no light. But the windows are not the light. They are where the light shines through. In the cathedral of the world, the light can refract in very different ways through two distinct windows, enlightening different faiths with different truths. Because none of us is fully able to comprehend the truth that shines through another person's window, nor to apprehend the falsehood that we ourselves may perceive as truth, we can easily mistake another's good for evil, and our own evil for good. Much of modern theology tempers the consequences of our inevitable ignorance while addressing the overarching crisis of our times, dogmatic division in an ever more intimate, fractious, and yet interdependent world. Of course, unless some criterion exists to test the validity of one's truth claims, any faith tradition lapses quickly into uncritical relativism. The criterion is this. Our degree of enlightenment will be reflected not in our faith claims, but in our lives. Enlightened behavior unites and heals. Benighted behavior mars and divides. Unless our faith, whatever its particulars may be, helps us to improve our lives, leading to integrity and a clear conscience, inspires us to reconcile with our neighbors, leading to peace, and plants our feet firmly on the ground of our being, uniting us with the one light, truth, God, whatever your term is. We've been blinded by the light that shines through our chosen window, unaware of the long shadow that those who bathe themselves blindly in the light too often cast. I think that sounds really nice, but again, how can such thoughts influence how we live our lives? Well, I think Doug Clark pointed us in the right direction with his recent comments in the News and Record about the National Folk Festival. Here's some of what he had to say. It wasn't just the same-sex pair strolling hand in hand, or the interracial couples with mixed-race kids, or women wearing headscarves, or the ubiquitous tattoos, or people with multiple piercings, brightly colored hair, or unusual clothing, or individuals whose gender wasn't easily discernible, or the many languages spoken. It was all of that and more. It was how natural it all was, how enjoyable. If there's one thing we need to build a better future in a fast-changing world, it's creativity. And that requires difference, because conformity is the antithesis of innovation. The beauty of the National Folk Festival, despite its moorings in traditional arts, is that it offers something different for most of us. It invites us to see and hear the world as other people express their experiences and emotions, their humanity. Okay, that was a few weeks ago. So what can we do today and tomorrow? I can only tell you what works for me. One thing I've tried to do over the years is intentionally and with some regularity spend time with people who are significantly different from me and with whom I would likely disagree on many things. I became acutely aware of the value of this practice during several trips that I had a chance to make to the Third World, working on construction projects in Mexico, Honduras, and the Dominican Republic. And the things I learned working alongside the local residents and artisans and craftspeople I have stuck with me. Also, as some of you know, I journey to the Outer Banks for a few days each May, where I meet up with a number of folks from my college days. This has been going on now for 32 years. Perhaps my favorite part of that trip is the conversations I have with a fellow who's a city councilman in Emporia, Virginia, a small city of about 6,000, right on 58 on the way to Virginia Beach. We're about as far apart politically as you could imagine, but I value more than I can express the degree of understanding I receive from those conversations with him regarding his point of view and why he thinks the way he does, and those things would otherwise escape me. I hope I do the same for him. That kind of interaction can be difficult to come by. A friend of mine has similar political differences with an occasional traveling companion, but this traveling companion feels threatened or attacked when asked, "Can you explain that further? Or can you help me better understand your point of view?" So perhaps I'm just especially fortunate in having found this kind of relationship. There's no doubt that I'm especially fortunate in having come to know a Somali refugee family who came to Greensboro from a refugee camp in Kenya in 1996. I had the opportunity to work with Omar, his wife, Tausia, and their 8 children as they settled into life in Greensboro and struggled with American customs, which seemed strange to them and flew in the face of many aspects of their culture. We were a bit wary of each other at first. Omar later told me that he feared his Muslim faith would be one of the things that was challenged. But over time, those fears were allayed and we developed a close friendship and learned many things from each other. He and Fasia now live in San Diego. Most of the kids are grown and living all across the country. I heard from Omar just a couple of weeks ago and was reminded again of how I am inestimably richer because of my friendship with that family. Another powerful outcome, this time through a chance meeting, comes from a friend who works extensively in voter registration. She, a white female, struck up a conversation with a gentleman of color during a voter registration session at a bus station not long ago. When she asked him if he was registered to vote, he launched into a story about how he had worked diligently on a previous campaign and had become completely disillusioned by the actions of his candidate once that candidate was in office. And he said something like, "All those politicians are alike. I'm not even going to vote anymore." My friend's reply tried to sympathize with his frustration and appreciate his point of view, but concluded by saying to him, "I really don't think that elections should be mainly decided by people who look like me." He seemed to appreciate that thought, but it didn't change his mind about voting, at least not at that moment. As they parted, my friend extended her hand. That took him aback. And he said, "I've never shaken hands with a white woman before."
So that was a powerful encounter for them both.
There's one more story I want to share with you, and I promise this is the last one. It comes from StoryCorps. And if you don't know StoryCorps, I commend it to you. It's one of the world's largest oral history projects. It's collected more than 60,000 stories in many different locations since it all began with one story booth in Grand Central Terminal in New York City in 2003. This comes from a fellow named Julio Diaz, a 30-something social worker who lives in New York. Almost every weeknight, as part of his daily routine, he ends his hour-long subway commute home to the Bronx one stop early, so he can eat dinner at his favorite diner. One night in February of 2008, as Diaz stepped off the number 6 train onto a nearly empty platform, his evening took an unexpected turn. This is his story in his own words.
So I get off the train, you know, I'm walking towards the stairs, and this young teenager pulls out a knife. He wants my money. So I just gave him my wallet and told him, here you go. He starts to leave, and as he's walking away, I'm like, hey, wait a minute, you forgot something. If you're going to be robbing people for the rest of the night, you might as well take my coat to keep you warm. So, you know, he's looking at me like, what's going on here, you know? And he asks me, well, why are you doing this? And I'm like, well, I don't know, man. If you're willing to risk your freedom for a few dollars, then I guess you must really need the money. I mean, all I wanted to do was go get dinner, and if you really want to join me, hey, you're more than welcome. So I'm like, look, you can follow me if you want. You know, I just felt maybe he really needs help. So, you know, we go into the diner where I normally eat. We sit down in the booth, and the manager comes by, the dishwashers come by, the waiters come by to say hi, you know. So the kid was like, man, but you know everybody here. Do you own this place? I'm like, no, I just eat here a lot. He's like, but you're even nice to the dishwasher. I'm like, well, haven't you been taught you should be nice to everybody? So he's like, yeah, but I didn't think people actually behave that way. So I just asked him in the end, I'm like, you know, what is it that you want out of life? He just had almost a sad face. Either he couldn't answer me or he didn't want to. The bill came, and I look at him and I'm like, look, I guess you're going to have to pay for this bill because you have my money and I can't pay for this. So if you give me my wallet back, I'll gladly treat you. He didn't even think about it. He's like, yeah, okay, here you go. So I got my wallet back, and I gave him $20 for it. You know, I figure maybe it'll help him, I don't know. And when I gave him the $20, I asked him to give me something in return, which was his knife, and he gave it to me. You know, it's funny because when I told my mom about what happened, you know, no mom wants to hear this, but with her, she was like, well, you know, you're the type of kid that always someone asked you for the time. You gave them your watch. I figure, you know, you treat people right, you can only hope that they treat you right. It's as simple as it gets in this complicated world.
Now, please understand, I don't advocate inviting your mugger to dinner. But we need to recognize that diversity and openness are under attack in many quarters. A backlash as some long privileged citizens feel their entitlements are being threatened. What I am suggesting is that we have surprising and often wondrous things to learn from fellow inhabitants of this cathedral of the world whose light may refract from windows different from ours. And one of the things we can derive from being part of this community is the support of the group when we stand in opposition to various forms of sexism and bigotry, whether we do it individually or as a community. I guess that among my hopes for us is simply an increased awareness of the fact that what we see is a function of how we look, of what we look at, of what we look for, and in particular of the filters that we place between ourselves and what's there before us, waiting to be seen. We have to be receptive to recognize what's being offered to us. Perhaps that awareness of those offerings could help us reconnect using a new fuse. So it's your turn. You want to do the intro? Okay, your turn. If you have thoughts to share or reactions or responses, Morgan will bring you the microphone. I will point out, in case I don't think we've mentioned it before, there was a wedding yesterday, in case you couldn't tell. A joyous event. Thoughts?
Mitch, it's interesting how we take things sometimes. I'm Ralph. When I saw your title, A Fuse, I thought of the extension of the thing that carries the fire to a firecracker or to a stick of dynamite, and a new fuse had a totally different meaning in the way that you talked about it as a circuit breaker.
Well, and it's certainly possible in the context of the play that the person who said, I need a new fuse, they may have meant it that way too. I'm just, you know, you can look at it either way. The play wound up being successful, by the way.
I just want to say thank you for the thoughtful message, and I may try to get the quote from the Unitarian minister from you.
Frank Forrester Church IV, son of Frank Forrester Church III, whom you may remember as Frank Church, who was a senator from Idaho, prominent in the 70s, I think, 60s or 70s. He was a pastor, a minister at, I think it's All Souls Church in New York for a number of years. And so this actually is part of a fairly long, that what I read to you was long. But it's part of a longer sermon. I think if you just Google it, Forrester Church, Cathedral of the World, you'll find the whole text, I think.